The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. For today's show, we're going to be reading from Oprah's quarterly magazine. This is from Volume 3, Number 3, 2023. The cover has Oprah in a white men's dress shirt walking on the beach, it looks like, or standing on the beach. And it says, the transformation issue, change is the greatest act of self-love. And she has a quote on the front, the whole point of being alive is to evolve into the complete person you were meant to be. Inside, we have a short little comment called, Here We Go. And there's a picture of Oprah, and she's wearing Oprah's own vintage Gianfranco Ferré, a classic she's glad she held on to. It's a white, looks like a men's dress shirt, with laced white all the way down, like lacing, like shoe lacing, all the way down the sleeves and in the front. And jeans and an NYDJ pearl earrings. One of my favorite Bible verses is, Be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. I love that. When you stay open, no matter what, letting each experience, even the tough ones, strengthen you and add deep depth and wisdom, you'll be awakened to greater heights. The stories of transformation in this issue are all about finding one's way to that more expansive life. Designer J.J. Martin shares one big shift, while other women reveal small but surprisingly meaningful changes, and Chip Conley invites us into a community he's built, the Modern Elder Academy, to nurture what he calls the midlife chrysalis. We've also included three exercises to help ignite your own evolution, plus a multi-page package on the change all women will go through, what Maria Shriver and I call the Big M, menopause. And rounding out the theme, our annual Beauty Awards for different and occasionally sparkling renewals. My hope is that this issue inspires you to stay open to the possibilities that continually unfold for us all. Oprah. Oprah has something called the O-List, Back to School Edition. Fall finds a perfect mix of the unexpected and the practical to help you kick off the season. A high note, send your kiddos off to school with confidence-boosting vibes. Tuck in one of these cards that care with lunch. Great for grown-ups, too, and they'll have a bite-sized afternoon pick-me-up of positivity. The color box design and letterpress lunchbox notes, they're originally $24 for $15, now 20% off with code OPRAH in capital letters. So they're little gold cards, and one of them says, You are my sunshine. Another, You've got this, with a thumbs up. Eat your vegetables. Good luck. It's Friday. Happy dance. Always be kind. Love you more with a little heart. Don't worry, be happy. Be brilliant. You make me proud. We've reached a section in the magazine that is What I Know for Sure, Special Menopause Guide. Oprah has a little article here. For 2 years, I didn't sleep well. Never a full night. No peace. Restlessness and heart palpitations were my steady companions at nightfall. This was back when I was 48 to 50. I went to see a cardiologist, took medication, wore a heart monitor for weeks, and then one day, walking through the offices of the Oprah Winfrey Show, I picked up a copy of The Wisdom of Menopause by Dr. Christiane Northrup's book. On the pages fell open to the heading, Palpitation, Your Heart's Wake-Up Call. I took it as a sign. Contained in that book was the answer I'd been going from doctor to doctor trying to figure out. Heart palpitations and sleeplessness were indications that the change was coming. But no one, including my trusted doctors, had warned me. And when my symptoms showed up, we looked for the most dire explanation, heart disease, instead of the most likely. Until the point in my adult life, I don't recall one serious conversation with another woman about what to expect. Sure, I'd heard about hot flashes, but I wasn't prepared for palpitations. I wasn't prepared to have such difficulty concentrating, reading, my favorite pastime, became a chore. Suddenly, my attitude toward most things was whatever. I wasn't vibrant. My whole world dulled down a couple of notches. When a friend mentioned that she'd felt the same dullness and that her doctor had recommended an estrogen supplement, bingo. For me, too, that proved to be the answer. I did multiple shows about my discovery, because at the time almost no one was talking about menopause. This year I invited Gail King, Maria Shriver, Drew Barrymore, Sharon Malone, M.D., Heather Hirsch, M.D., and Oprah Daily Insiders to continue the conversation. Why? Because so many women still continue to feel shame or confusion or frustration about this phase of life. If you're one of them, what you need to know for sure is that you're not alone, and you can also find help starting with these pages. The next one says, all the symptoms of menopause. You're welcome. Here they are. Music, tension, and aches. Difficulty concentrating. Electric shock sensations. Irritability. Sleep disturbance. Brittle nails. Thinning hair. Joint pain. Weight gain. Burning mouth. Depression, memory lapses, changes in taste, dizzy spells, bloating, anxiety, allergies, night sweats, mood changes, vaginal dryness, headaches, irregular periods, fatigue, decreased libido, body odor, panic disorder, breast soreness, stressed incontinence, irregular heartbeat, osteoporosis, itchiness, tingling extremities, other digestive changes. Note, not everyone gets every symptom. The next article is Period, End of Story by Kira von Eichel, E-I-C-H-E-L. A little known cause of early menopause is extreme stress. One woman reflects on the family crisis that shocked her world and then her body to the core. I knew a woman whose family fled the Soviet Union in 1985 when she was 7. At the train station just before the border, her mother was taken into custody by Soviet guards. In the 24 hours they held her mother, a circle of hair from the child's scalp simply fell out. Her mother was released. They made it to Italy, and by the time they had settled in Baltimore, her hair had grown back. The story always stayed with me. What the fear of losing her mother will do to the child's body in a matter of hours. In my case, it was the inverse. I was in my early 40s when, out of the blue, we had a very sick child. I didn't lose my hair all at once, but my body changed almost overnight. We went from being a normal enough family to one in a constant state of crisis. I spent hours every day filling out forms in waiting rooms, arguing with arrogant doctors and insurance companies, pleading with kindly ones, alternating all-night vigils with my husband. I became a desperate comber of articles, medical papers, and blogs. I arranged meetings with friends of friends of friends who might have a lead, anything to grab hold of some invisible steering wheel that would give us the illusion of control. My husband and I were like harried army medics, and as nothing upon nothing worked, the wonderful us we had been just faded into two exhausted housemates who happened to share children. Mounting terror and disagreement slowly calcified into resentment. I tried to keep dates with friends, and if I made it to the appointed place at the appointed time, I tried not to cry, and often failed. The best people stuck around, but many others fell away. I was also still trying to keep our other child's life humming. School events, volleyball tournaments, birthday parties, appointments, mother-daughter dates. In theory, I was a machine in killing it, and looking back with empathy for that woman in her early 40s, I do see a fierce warrior queen who swam people to shore with one arm tied behind her back. The gift of motherhood is that you believe you can actually lift a car if needed. Even with life sliding quickly from a recognizable path, you tell yourself you will find a solution and you will fix everything for everyone. But something always gives. This time it was my body that gave. In spite of a pretty healthy lifestyle, I gained 25 pounds. Parts of my body I'd never thought could expand seemed almost cartoonish as they bulged and stretched, like puberty on fast forward. If you added another set of breasts on top of the ones already there, a once thick mane of hair was now diminished, collecting around the shower drain seemingly by the handful with each washing. Every morning I awoke to the imprint of a sweat-drenched body on my sheets, like a chalk outline of a formerly functioning self. At the cocktail parties I dragged myself to maintain some semblance of a social life, even as I knew an emergency call would drag me home minutes after arriving. I flushed hot as the earth's iron core from the inside out with the first glass of red wine, or if conversation got awkward. "Is it hot in here?" I wondered aloud as I peeled off as many layers as I politely could mid-party. Everything was bone on bone. Noises. People. Even worse, a once wonderful, fun, close, and happy sex life disappeared. I had always loved men, and most especially the one I'd chosen. Suddenly I was meh. And so we moved further apart still. It must be stress, I thought. A smart friend wasn't buying it and recommended I get checked for an autoimmune condition or a thyroid issue. After 18 tubes of blood were processed, the answer came back that I was, by the numbers, menopausal. "But I haven't even experienced perimenopause," I said, somewhat dazed. "When was my last period?" "I didn't remember. Too busy." "When did your mother experience it?" "Later." "Usually it tracks," the doctor said. "She asked me if there was anything unusual going on." She had a kind, concerned look on her face, and I told her the same way I told everyone then. A litany of sad details repeated so often to doctors and specialists that it sounded like a school prayer or a mantra, a series of lines that had come to define us. She nodded as she kept steady eye contact and told me that extreme stress can accelerate menopause. I thought of my friend who'd lost her hair when she thought she'd lost her mother. Was my body so on the nose, such a cliché, that any threat to its offspring would flip my reproductive kill switch? I came home stunned and a little relieved. After languishing in the soupy, hellish limbo of no real answers or solutions in every other aspect of life, this was at least tangible, and by now I was an expert, PhD-level researcher. I was going to slay menopause, at least I thought my husband, almost as an afterthought, with a sort of get-a-load-of-this-style bewilderment. He barely registered it. Huh, funny. And on to putting out the next fire. That night it occurred to me that this was the end of something, and that I had no clue what the other thing after the something was going to be. For about 3 days I fixated on this shift in identity. Who was I without my period? Would I still be attractive? Sexy? Juicy? Was it something to be grieved? All the physical discomfort aside, something felt like it was being wrested from me against my will. The end of fertility felt like the end of me, or of some secret special vibrancy accorded me by the slightly miraculous alchemy my body performed each month. The Dylan line comes to mind, "Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now." God, I was earnest and misguided, and I took the idea of fertility so seriously, even though I was finished with having kids. In a way, the ongoing high-stakes juggling act I was engaged in was helpful. I would say that I mourned my idée fixe of my fruitfulness and sexiness for about a minute. I was aware of the thought, and then life just needed me to move on, fast. I did have to deal with the very real symptoms. On top of the body going wonky, I found myself standing in front of my desk, at the bottom of the stairs, in my child's room, rooted in place, wondering what I was doing there. Had I filled out this form? Returned that call? Picked up food? It was like trying to grasp at mist. On the other end of the spectrum, things like the wrong non-organic milk made me want to stuff my fist in my mouth and scream into the void. The extremes were unbearable bedfellows. They were disruptive and not helping me be the person I needed to be. A true child of the 1970s, I researched and tried every tea and herb and modality out there. Nothing helped enough. I learned Vedic meditation. That helped with a lot of other things. Thank you, Robert Hammond. I ate only the good, nutritious things. I did yoga. Thank you, Kula Yoga. But I was still trying to function with what felt like giant ballasts, pulling me below the waistline, below the waterline after each attempt to clear it. And the messaging from the profit-generating world of how to be a better woman was telegraphing that if I only did more, ate less, purchased more powders and creams, I would be in control of my destiny. Finally, after much research about the misleading Women's Health Initiative study from 2002 that scared a generation of women off hormone replacement therapy and consultation with my doctor, I started bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. The best way to describe what happened once that kicked in is that you could throw a refrigerator at me and I would catch it. No sweat. Maybe even while holding an inexpert but informed conversation about nuclear fission on the side. Eventually, I switched to regular hormone replacement therapy. My executive function skills are just too lacking for the bioidentical rigmarole. There's something that we might stimulate my system enough to get it all back. It never did come back. But here's the funny thing. Now at 50 and watching all my close friends get thrown into the spin cycle, what a gift, a release, a deliverance too. I love being done. I love the benefits of being postmenopausal. Beyond the freedom from the monthly peace, other things happened. I got calmer, stronger, wiser, less risible. My perspective on people, things, life got longer and kinder. More important than anything at all, our kid got better. And I know to be grateful for it every single minute of every day. My husband came closer again. We decided to ditch the alienated housemaid things and remember that we fell in love way back in the early 1990s for some excellent reasons. I'm grateful for that too. I missed him. The desire came back, more intentional and sweet than the passion. I also learned that most people are only there for the good times, and they disappear fast in the bad. It sounds like a terrible and awful disappointing lesson. Ultimately, it wasn't. It makes you absolutely cherish the ones who stick around. Even when you're faltering and breaking, you end up feeling very rich in human kindness and generosity. Grateful. It's a pretty my cup runneth over feeling. I didn't stop existing when I went through menopause unexpectedly early. It's like I got to walk through a secret door. I am still a woman. I am still sexual. But a lot of the noise is gone. I am less distracted. By now it's a worn cliche, but you really do care less about what other people think. There's a contentment that grows deeper roots. It isn't a giving up or settling for less, per se. It's an even wilder thing. It opens up whole worlds. You'd otherwise never have noticed. Sometimes when I'm feeling particularly grateful for all this change wrought, that old maybe it's Maybelline ad runs through my head, and I picture myself and my brilliant, wise, funny friends looking resplendently our age, gallivanting across the city street, and I replace the tagline with, maybe it's menopause. There's a quick quote after that article. This is a quote by Drew Barrymore at our The Life You Want discussion. She said, I wouldn't get in the DeLorean and go back for anything. I've never been happier. I've never been more sane. I've never been wiser. This article is entitled Happy 40th Birthday. Now read this. A No BS Perimenopause Cheat Sheet by Jill Herzig. And that's H-E-R-Z-I-G. Despite the many condolences I received on my 40th birthday, I felt elated. I thought I had all the gifts I needed to take on my next decade. 2 years later, family and work were still humming along fine, but my body was in full freakout for reasons I couldn't fathom. Unbeknownst to me, I had entered the hormonal hurricane of perimenopause. The symptoms made every facet of my life more difficult for more than a decade, and here's the infuriating part. Every moment of suffering was unnecessary. If someone had handed me a blunt rundown of menopause basics on that big birthday, I would have gone and prepared, gotten the help I needed, and sailed toward 50, healthier and more hopeful. But no one did. So this is it. The to-the-point menopause manual. I wish I'd been given as my birthday present to every woman on or near her 40th birthday. It may not be the sparkly thing you want, but believe me, this knowledge is invaluable. Buckle up, things are about to get weird. Starting for most women in the mid-40s, hormones begin to fluctuate. For at least 80% of women, the ups and downs cause dozens of symptoms, not just periods that come late or early, lighter or gushingly heavy. Bottom line, if you think it's your hormones, it probably is. Your experience will be completely unique. On average, perimenopause starts in your mid-40s, but it may kick off as early as your 30s or as late as your 50s. Symptoms morph, wax, and wane, and the whole shebang lasts a decade on average through menopause. For an unlucky 10% of us, it's a rest of your life situation. There are really good, safe meds for all of this. In fact, we've had FDA-approved solutions for symptoms of perimenopause and menopause for decades. For the vast majority of healthy women, hormone therapy is safe. Can't take hormones? You can still get relief. A trained clinician can guide you toward non-hormonal solutions for menopause symptoms. There's no medal for toughing it out. Maybe you're thinking that you can hack it without intervention. I will just point out, no one greets you at the finish line of life and says, "Congratulations! You endured decades of hot flashes and crappy sleep without any medical support at all." I know you're strong. You know you're strong. You've proven that just by living in a female body for decades. But how much stronger could you be if you subtracted menopause symptoms from your personal equation? The next article on menopause, four more things we know about perimenopause. For women in their 40s and those in their 30s who are already feeling the effects or just want to know what's coming. This article is by Adele Jackson Gibson. Number one, you can't really test for it. There are several at-home blood tests sold online claiming to analyze your hormone balance and tell you how close to menopause you are. They typically monitor levels of estrogen, luteinizing hormones, and follicle-stimulating hormone, all important for ovulation. But one blood test won't count for the unpredictable rise and fall of hormones during your transition. Perimenopause is generally diagnosed clinically, meaning that a doctor will factor in your age, medical history, family history, and symptoms. Number two, genes and race can impact the timing, duration, and severity of symptoms. Recent studies have shown that genetics and family history play a major role in determining the age you reach menopause. If everybody in your family went through it early, chances are you might as well, says Suzanne Gilberg Lenz, MD, the author of Menopause Bootcamp. Women of color tend to start perimenopause earlier and have more severe hot flashes than white women, according to the SWAN study, which followed a racially, ethnically, and geographically diverse group of 3,302 perimenopausal women. On top of that, Black and Latino women experience perimenopause symptoms about 2 to 4 years longer than white women. The reasons for these variations are complex, since factors like socioeconomic status, quality of life, access to education, and immigration status all play a role, and in general, stress and anxiety have been known to worsen hot flashes. Fortunately, there are expanding networks of POC physicians dedicated to serving their communities. Number three, perimenopause messes with your sex drive. Part of the reason may be that testosterone declines during the menopause transition, but to boil sex drive down to testosterone is ridiculous, says Gilbert Lenz, who stresses that libido is multifaceted. It's affected by your energy and stress levels and the sense of connection, or lack of connection, you have with your partner. Perimenopause can also make sex less pleasurable or even uncomfortable. As if that weren't enough of a downer, changes in blood flow and the nerves in the vagina can hamper its response time to pleasure, says Gilbert Lenz. Thankfully, there are easy fixes. Lube can help to add moisture, and vibrators have been proven effective in improving blood flow to the vagina. You can also speak to your doctor about estrogen in the form of a suppository or cream. Number four, regular exercise helps offset the health risks. Those risks include bone disease, heart disease, and dementia. Yikes! If there's one piece of advice Jen Gunter, MD, author of the Menopause Manifesto, could give to anyone in their 30s, it's to start strength training now when you're still producing estrogen, a hormone that is essential to maintaining healthy bones. When levels drop, your risk of developing osteoporosis, a condition in which the bones become brittle, increases. According to experts at the Endocrine Society, additionally, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services suggests moderate cardio, like walking at least 150 minutes a week, or vigorous cardio, for example, a kickboxing class, for at least 75 minutes a week. The next article in our menopause section is What is Normal When It Comes to Menopause? Why Trying to Define What's Normal for All Women Will Likely Leave Black Women Behind, by Omisade, that's O-M-I-S-A-D-E, Bernie Scott, and Jennifer Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, Wolf. Hint? Nothing. More than a billion people worldwide will be in menopause by 2025. Every day in the United States, an estimated 6,000 Gen Xers, like the two of us, are entertaining menopause. We're both proud to be part of the generation breaking the silence and smashing the stigma that has long shrouded this transition. Leading women like Oprah Winfrey, Michelle Obama, and Tracy Ellis Ross have gone public with their experiences. By all accounts, the menopause market is booming, from emerging telehealth enterprises to wellness empires. More and more, employers are implementing menopause-friendly work policies, a topic now regularly covered in journals like Harvard Business Review. Even Congress has gotten the memo. Last fall, the Bipartisan Menopause Research Act of 2022 was introduced into the House, a bill that would require an evaluation of menopause-related research and a federal plan of action to resolve any gaps. It would seem we are on the brink of a new movement. Dare we say era for menopause? And to be honest, that gives us pause, because any time a social shift is so deliberately defined, so rapturously reflected and reported on, the first question we inevitably ask ourselves is this: who stands to be left behind? The New York Times recently stepped up to answer this question, posting a solicitation for testimonies titled "What is Menopause Like for Women of Color?" The accompanying article points out that race and socioeconomic status can play a factor in the menopause experience. Whether it presents as severity or duration of specific physical responses or symptoms. On its face, the Times query is not an unreasonable one. Indeed, in our respective advocacy practices, each of us is often asked, why do black women have different menopause experiences? But it's crucial that the impulse to ask and answer this question doesn't devolve into an acceptance of assumptions, namely that there is something inherently flawed about black women and women of color, and women-identified or gender-expansive people, too. Our worry is that the medical community has already and will continue to designate a normal, and therefore abnormal, menopause experience. Throughout our nation's history, whiteness and the experience of white people has been centered as the norm. Whatever happens outside the norm is othered or marginalized. History also teaches us that toying with normalcy without considering the diversity of experiences and applying critical analysis can be a slippery slope, one that reinforces implicit bias and health disparities based on gender and race. A designation of abnormal quickly becomes a cudgel. For example, women are twice as likely to experience mental health issues as men. But as many as half are misdiagnosed. Such is also the case for the U.S. crisis-level maternal mortality rates as it relates to racial bias. The underlying logic is that there is something physiologically different or faulty about non-white women, implying their basic lack of humanity. This is especially true for black women, who are three times more likely to die from pregnancy and related causes than white women. For black women, humanity and personhood have tacitly been questioned regarding pain, symptomatology, and treatment extending back to their arrival in this country as enslaved people. This thinking made it possible for the father of gynecology, J. Marion Sims, to perform medical experiments on enslaved women without anesthesia or consideration for their immediate and lifelong pain they would and did experience. While white women during this time period were put on a patriarchal pedestal of the cult of true womanhood, black women, enslaved or not, were deemed less than human. At its core, menopause is not a one-size-fits-all experience, but a very individualized and dynamic transformation. Menopause is physical, yes, and it is also cultural and social and political. The context surrounding one's menopause journey, our family of origin, culture, and systemic oppression, plays a major role in health equity, generally, and is further amplified or exacerbated by our intersectional identities, which include everything from gender and race to socioeconomic class, sexuality, lived experience, and educational background, among others. All of which is why it is critical to intentionally call out the biases behind how people experience menopause. In turn, this will better ensure respectful treatment and quality care. Addressing the connective tissue between varying experiences isn't just about medical disparity. Words like normal have policy implications, too. Given that we are on the precipice of more menopause reforms in workplaces and heightened interest on the part of legislators, we need to be careful that disparities aren't baked into law. For example, up until now, menopause-focused legal claims filed under the Americans with Disabilities Act have largely hinged on whether the court considers menopause a normal consequence of human aging. As soon as any benchmark is set for normalcy, anything outside of that range may face political headwinds or different treatments under the law. Here's the mandate by which we abide, and we encourage the same of others. Tread carefully in attempt to define or drive the narrative of what is a natural or normal menopause. It will inevitably play a role in how millions are treated by healthcare providers, policymakers, and employers, and in the body politic. This next article is A to Z, a special menopause guide. B is for brain fog. This is one of the earliest signs. It's often dismissed by doctors. It's probably stress, they say. But you know it's way too real as I start losing words and forgetting the obvious, and suddenly a simple instruction sheet looks like string theory because the information is not getting into your head. We're used to our bodies going UFO on us, but having our minds abducted by some alien force? There are some women whose brains are exquisitely sensitive to changes in estrogen in terms of their cognitive function, says Pauline Maki, M-A-K-I, Ph.D., a professor of psychiatry, psychology, and obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Brain fog is also often related to your sleep being disturbed by night sweats, and if that's the case, menopausal hormone therapy could help. Otherwise, it's not so clear. What does improve things, says Maki, is aerobic exercise, restricting alcohol, and challenging your brain by learning in something new. One bright note, for many women in the first year or two of postmenopause, the fog lifts. L is for libido. Dwindling hormones can evaporate your lust, but sexual desire is so enigmatic, it's hard to pin down what's making it dip. Hypertension, medications, and antidepressants, caretaking stress, and not having a minute to yourself could all be killing the mood. Also, how's your relationship going? People want me to write a prescription, says Makeba, that's M-A-K-E-B-A, Williams, M.D., an associate professor at Washington University in St. Louis, School of Medicine. But nothing I prescribe is going to be helpful if you don't like your partner. I is for insomnia. We know that not getting enough shut-eye takes a toll on your body, and that certainly happens when you're woken up by drenching sweats and having to pee a million times and can't get back to sleep. But in the menopausal period, says Hadine Joffe, J-O-F-F-E, M.D., professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, you have two more strikes against you. First, research shows that you can wake up in the middle of the night even if you don't have night sweats. But say you have them. Even when you slip back to sleep and get a full 8 hours, you're still likely to suffer. If somebody had two flashes last night, Joffe says, we've shown that the non-hot flash part of their sleep is usually very poor. It's bad sleep because the temperature and changes are all off. That can make your brain foggy, mood worse, and energy flag while firing up the old appetite hormones, which leads to weight gain. Focusing on consolidated sleep is key, she says, ideally without sleep medications. Cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia has been shown to be just as effective with zero side effects. Q is for questions to ask on OBGYN or an internist. To get the most out of a visit, track your period, when it starts and ends, how heavy it is, and any symptoms, cramps, hot flashes, etc., that come with it, says Irene Anine, A-N-I-N-Y-E, PhD of the Society for Women's Health Research, SWHR. It will help pin down when you are actually in menopause, since even without brain fog, it's hard to remember when your last period was. If your doc suggests menopausal hormone therapy or other drugs, says Anine, ask, how long before I should expect relief? What does relief look like? What are the risks and the side effects? If you don't feel heard, and you'll probably know that halfway through the appointment, you should find another doctor. A few resources: the North American Menopause Society, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, National Menopause Foundation, and SWHR's Toolkit. Z is for zenith. You've got wisdom, experience, and passion, and you never have to deal with a jammed tampon dispenser in the restroom again. Most of these bodily injustices can be treated. Many will pass, and you have a world of female sisterhood who can relate. It's time to focus on what you want. No more emotional zigzagging or zombie brain. Just zest for life and the deep zen of knowing you've arrived. Next, we have some quotes about some of the women who have been talking about menopause. This first quote is from Maria Shriver. I feel better at this age than I did in my 20s and 30s. I feel hot. I feel energized. I want my daughters to see that, and I want my sons to think they will stand up next time next to a woman at every decade. This quote is from Heather Hirsch, MD. You can't yoga your way out of this. You can't eat your way out of this. It's just going to happen to every woman on the planet. This quote is by Gail King. I wish I had listened more because I suffered many times with pain or with these wicked, wicked hot flashes where you're on a red carpet and even the paparazzi goes, Gail, are you all right? This one is by Sharon Malone, MD. During perimenopause, your brain is doing all kinds of things that are betraying you. Once you get beyond this, most women tend to recover. And the last quote is from Drew Barrymore. I feel like I'm showing up at the doctor's office really well prepared with all of my track record, my dates, my answers, my questions, but I feel completely clueless right now. I'd love a map because I'm there. This next article is written by Deborah Kopaken, and it's C-O-P-A-K-E-N. How to hack your insurance so you can get the hormones you need. If I were a middle-aged man suffering from erectile dysfunction, I could walk into my neighborhood pharmacy and buy a 30-day supply of sildenafil, the generic for Viagra, for $88 + $67 out of pocket, and no, that's not the insurance copay. That's the basic cash cost with a coupon. A menopausal woman in search of affordable estrogen, however, a requirement not just for her sexual health, but for her overall health and well-being, has to deal with a lot more. To give you an idea of what monthly systemic estrogen and local vaginal estrogen costs look like on a personal level, because each woman's needs and symptoms can vary as widely as her insurance coverage, her medical history, and the costs of medications where she lives, allow me to present my own monthly costs as a typical example. I just turned 57 years old. I live in Brooklyn, New York, and after years of suffering through adenomyosis, I no longer have a uterus. I am covered by a laughably bad state-sponsored health insurance with a $6,100 deductible. Before starting on estrogen, I was plagued by migraine headaches, hot flashes, brain fog, mood swings, loss of bone density, thinning vaginal tissue, and recurring UTIs. To combat these, I take 3 types of estrogen, 1 systemic and 2 vaginal. Minus a uterus, I do not need to pay extras every month for progesterone. My systemic estrogen is Divigel, a gel I put on my thigh once daily after a shower because I recently had to switch my insurance from bad to worse. Its cost just shot up from an insurance copay of $35 a month to a whopping $144. My two vaginal hormones, which I plan to take until death do us part, are as follows. A generic estradiol vaginal tablet, which I insert with an application into the vagina canal 3 nights a week. $35 for 36 tablets, so approximately $11.67 a month. And a daily generic estradiol cream, which my doctor just added after my UTI started coming back. Falling in love in one's 50s, while a miracle, can also be a health hazard. I smear a hefty dose of this cream all over my urethra, labia minora, and vaginal opening every night. I paid $104.88 insurance copay last month for a tube that should last me 3 months. So let's call that $34.96 a month. That's $190.63 per month for medications without, which I cannot have comfortable sex, physical well-being, or a productive and symptom-free life. At one point last year, I considered flying to Paris to purchase a year's supply of my menopause medications. When I did the math, factoring in staying with a friend for free, I came out ahead with plenty of money left over for croissants. It was only in doing the research for this story that I realized I am spending far too much on estrogen copays every month, and I cover this kind of stuff for a living. It's been hard for me to navigate this non-transparent system. I can only imagine what it's like for everyone else. This next article is Menopause by the Numbers. The good, the bad, the can you believe it? 340 million. Between 1999 and 2011, just one aspect of menopause, vasomotor symptoms, also known as VMS, or hot flashes, cost companies this much money annually. Women who suffered from hot flashes made 1.5 million more health visits than women who didn't experience them. 2 to 4 years. The amount of time longer than white women that black and Latino women experience perimenopause symptoms. 20%. The number of OBGYN residency programs that provide any kind of menopause training. Up to 80%. Women who report having hot flashes, commonly called vasomotor symptoms or VMS. $17 billion. How big the global menopause market has grown. 8.5. On average, black women reach menopause 8.5 months earlier than white women and have worse symptoms such as hot flashes, depression, and sleep disturbances, but are less likely to receive hormone therapy as well as medical and mental health services. Nearly 80%. The number of medical residents who admit that they feel barely comfortable discussing or treating menopause. An estimated 6,000. The number of Gen X women who enter menopause each day in the U.S. Fatigue. A global survey found the symptom to be women's number one complaint. Parts of that article were edited due to time. And one more little statement on menopause. One awesome thing about life after menopause? What one woman told us about being over the hump? Cue George Michael's Freedom. Sex is stress-free and you feel good in your own skin. You get to have sex and not worry about getting pregnant. And yes, you can maintain an active and healthy sex life. Your body does change. You realize that it's really not so much about how the body looks, but how it functions. If it's functioning well, but there's a little bit of extra padding, who cares? That was by Caroline, 57, attorney, Sandy Hook, Connecticut. This next article is This Changes Everything. If a flaw in your appearance crushes your confidence, address it already. These three women did and can't believe they waited so long. First one is I got braces at 50. For decades, Catherine Hong never showed her teeth when she smiled. What else was she repressing? As I hit middle age, I'm guilty of wanting to hold back time. I dread deadlines, facial lines, and annual doctor visits. I mourn the days when I could carry my children on my hips. I don't want my parents, now in their 80s, to get a day older, and if I really must be honest, I'll confess that deep down inside, I wish time wouldn't speed along quite so fast, because even at 52, I feel like I need more time to accomplish all the other stuff, personal, professional, I was supposed to as a grown-up. But recently, I've developed a new craving, one in direct contradiction to this yearning. I want time to zip by. I fantasize about falling into bed and waking up 6 months, well, 9 months, a whole year into the future. This is because I have braces. 17 months ago, after years of hemming, hawing, and trying to convince myself I should focus on self-improvement of the less vain and superficial variety, I surrendered myself to an orthodontist. The same orthodontist, in fact, who fixed my daughter's teeth when she was in 7th grade, and who has probably had his hands in the mouth of a quarter of the kids in our town. I sat myself down across from him, pointed to my teeth, and said, "I need to fix these." To put it bluntly, I had some really bad buck teeth. My two top front chompers were pushed so far out beyond my other teeth that they had practically formed their own archipelago disconnected from the mainland. They also seemed larger than they had any right to be, monstrous in both height and width. They were like two obnoxious people who showed up to a concert in a public park and plopped a pair of giant lawn chairs front and center, blocking the view of everyone sitting on the grass. I had problems with other teeth, too, including lateral incisors on the top and bottom that jutted out at awkward angles, like cars parked in a hurry outside an emergency room. These teeth of mine were the cause of more shame than I like to admit. I grew up comfortably in a nice Long Island suburb where my parents, Korean immigrants, paid for my first round of braces when I was 12. But I still couldn't shake the feeling that my teeth somehow suggested an ignoble and backward upbringing in my mind. My mouth conjured every cringe-inducing caricature of a hayseed-chewing hillbilly, or, more pertinently, in my case, every offensive turn-off-the-century cartoon I had ever seen of buck-toothed coolies in conical bamboo hats. The few friends to whom I have confessed my hang-up invariably try to soothe me, saying things like, "What do you mean?" or "I never noticed anything about your teeth." These lies only make me even more uncomfortable, because I'm embarrassed for the friend forced to tell the lie. Needless to say, I have no ambitions for dazzling, flawless teeth. All I want are teeth that are perfectly unremarkable. Sometimes, when I scrutinized myself in photos, I would catch the sight of the corner of one of my front teeth peeking out through my otherwise closed lips, like a wayward tic-tac. I mastered a smile like the kind a child draws in a stick figure drawing, a single curved line upturned at the end, and I'll never forget mortifying moments about a decade ago when our family had just moved from the city to the suburbs. I was standing by the jungle gym at the school playground when a little boy, not more than 7 years old, looked me squarely in the eyes and said, "Why do your teeth look like that?" Oh, the honesty of youth. Sometimes I see that little truth-teller walking around the town. He's in high school now and still have the urge to push him off the monkey bars. It was the pandemic that finally got me into the orthodontist's chair. During that weird time after the first wave, when people were cautiously getting together again, we met outdoors, we elbow-bumped, we tentatively hugged, and we were always, always masked. And that's when I realized something. Whenever I smiled, talked, or laughed, I felt unfamiliar sensations in the muscles of my face. I sensed a not unpleasant crinkling in the outer corners of my eyes and a weirdly relaxed feeling in my cheeks and my lips. I felt strangely liberated. Oh, my God, I was smiling with my whole face, my teeth safely hidden behind a mask. I was unconsciously allowing my body to do what came naturally, to spill out big goofy grins, smiling so unguardedly I actually felt happier. And though I am usually the first to roll my eyes at such language, I think I understand in that split second what yoga teachers mean when they tell you to let your body and spirit become one. I recalled once reading an article explaining that the very act of physically smiling has been found to trigger people's brains to release dopamine and serotonin, and lo, I realized it was true. All these years I had been tamping down my happiness for my own idiotic vanity, and boy, did I feel stupid about it. But at this point, I couldn't retrain my brain to stop worrying about what people thought of my teeth. I couldn't just tell myself, "Get over it." I needed to fix my teeth. It would be cheaper than therapy, too. While Invisalign or other clear aligners would have been so much more dignified, I was told my case required good old-fashioned braces. Evidently, clear aligners would expand my overcrowding arch, testing the limits of my already receding gums. sadly not uncommon in someone over 50. So I went all in. I got four teeth extracted to make the requisite room, and in October 2021, the braces went on. The clunky kind with braces, brackets, and wires, and little hooks into which I can attach tiny rubber bands. On top of the brackets are tooth-colored ceramic, subtler than metal braces, but still in no way invisible. And on the bottom, they're metal, just as shiny and unmistakable as I remember from when I was 12. They give my mouth an incongruous gleam whenever I speak, eat, or laugh like a shiny new zipper on an old pair of pants. I faithfully visit my orthodontist every 5 weeks for tightenings, where I am, of course, always the oldest patient in his wood-paneled waiting room, a humiliation I try to bear by avoiding eye contact with the kids on their way to piano lessons. Nobody wants to hear someone complaining about getting their teeth straightened, which is about as hard to empathize with as someone grousing about how their ski boots hurt. So I will try to keep this next part brief. Getting braces as an adult is painful, more so than I remember from childhood, because the roots of my teeth are in a constant state of shifting. My teeth feel weak and wobbly all the time. The list of foods I now avoid includes everything from whole apples and almonds to pizza crust and the crunchy, sticky coating of Korean fried chicken. Eating in public is a minefield. Spinach gets snagged on the wires like flotsam on a fishing line, tangled in a knot that no tongue can discreetly undo. Certain foods, red wine, coffee, and tomato sauce, stain the elastic ligatures installed along the front of my braces. Worst are curries or anything with a turmeric, which leaves my mouth with a sickly yellow gleam. The final indignity is one I cannot even hide behind a mask. I now have a lisp, not ideal for someone who co-hosts a podcast, and fatal for my relationship with Siri, whose invariably reply to my requests is now, "I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that." So each night as I stand at the bathroom mirror, attempting in vain to thoroughly floss, I wish time would move a little faster. I fantasize about the hibernating until the day the braces come off, a gray-haired orthodontist version of the protagonist in Artessa Moshfeghs, and that's Moshfegh, novel My Year of Rest and Relaxation. But I am pleased to report my teeth are discernibly much improved. The gaps left by the extractions have closed up. My overbite has scooted back to the front row at the concert, and it turns out that my two front teeth aren't actually any bigger than they're supposed to be. As my doctor had promised, they only appeared that way because they were so proclined and procumbent. Frustratingly, he refuses to tell me when I'll get the braces off. He says he's learned not to get patients' hopes up. This fabled day seems to be still several months down the line. So I think about time and how I want it to fly, but also how many years of adulthood I've wasted feeling bad about my teeth. Smiling my tight quarter smile and believing I was too old to overhaul something that bothered me so deeply. Getting braces at 50 certainly wasn't too late, but I gained nothing from waiting. The truth is, getting these braces was the easy part. All I had to do was find a good orthodontist and let time do its thing. When it comes to fulfilling life's ambitions, however, that's something only I can do for myself. At this point, I don't have time to waste in delaying anything, least of all the goals I dreamed up for myself when I had braces the first time around. I'll be happy when these braces come off, but I want to feel like I've earned this new smile, and for that, I may need just a little more time. We're going back over to Oprah's O-List. These are some suggestions she has for things you might be interested in purchasing. Show of hands. Even post-grad signet rings are always a great idea, a nod to collegiate chic. These gold-plated sparklers come in clean, monogrammed, and enamel-embellished styles. They're originally $118 to $178. They're now 20% off with code OPRA, and that's capitalized. Bright now. Meet the Goldilocks of puffers. It's just the right thickness to get through the seasonal shift in style, thanks to the fun color selection, plus it's sustainably made without feathers. They're Kyla hooded jackets, and they show here an orange, a bright neon green, a pink, and a blue. They're originally $188 each, but they're now 20% off with the code OPRA. Wake up call. Forget that iced coffee run. Now you can make cold brew at home. Pop a pod into the brand's smallest coffee maker, and it can brew a hot cup, too. It's VertuoPop, V-E-R-T-U-O, and then P-O-P plus. It's $129 at Nespresso.com. A matter of time. Here are compelling and colorful reasons to wear a watch. With their striking gradient strap, these digital mood boosters are water-resistant and up to 30 meters. TBO watch, originally $99, they're each now 20% off with the code Oprah. And they're like bright blue with some pink towards the digital watch, and then there's a pink one with some yellow towards the digital watch, and then a green with blue towards the digital watch. Meal ticket. Leftovers look extra enticing with this elegant 14-piece storage set. It's made from non-toxic ceramic-coated glass in 6 shades, and the special included organizers help keep chaos out of your cabinets. Food storage set, it's $244 at carawayhome.com. The watches at a matter of time also are at timex.com. I forgot to say that. So these carriers, I see gray and red and blue and green for the meal ticket. Bag swag. Show school spirits and support sustainably with these large and in-charge totes made with 70% recycled plastic, lightweight yet sturdy, and they come in an array of school colors for extra game day prep. Spirit Tailgate Totes. $68 now, 20% off with the code Oprah, again in capital letters. And it's made by Handyby, HANDEDBY-USA.com. Here are some book recommendations. In the reading room, Glorious Globetrotting Books. This one is Loot by Tanya James, T-A-N-I-A. In an 18th century Indian kingdom, a gifted 17-year-old boy crafts an automated wooden tiger with his French mentor, a genius clockmaker. The story of the tiger's theft by colonist British forces and its recovery by its maker spans 50 years, moving from Mysore to France and England, each evoked in kaleidoscopic period detail. James' ravishing prose and trademark blend of lyricism and suspense animate this ingenious caper meets politically acute coming-of-age story. And My Murder by Katie Williams. Lou, a wife and mother murdered by a serial killer, is returned to her family by way of government-sponsored cloning. She looks the same, feels the same, and remembers everything except the circumstances of her death. Putting a speculative fiction twist on the domestic thriller, Williams has created an immersive literary thrill ride, sending you your kids to the amusement park and get on the roller coaster. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.